Direction. And this is joint work with Ben Brown, Michael Castoriano, and one of Michael's previous students, Quentin Mario. Someone who speaks French can probably correct their pronunciation. So I'm going to start with a quick recap of some things which are probably familiar to most of the people here. So I'll try and go quickly. And let me know if you can't see. I don't often write on chalkboard anymore. So. Okay, so in topological quantum error correction, the basic idea is we have a qubit, which I'm going to represent by a line. And we can imagine some very, very simple noise model, which I'm going to use here, which is this one. With some probability p, an x is applied to the qubit. With some probability p, a z is applied. And therefore, from that, we know that with some probability p squared, both of these operations happen, and x and z are applied, which is the same as a y. And with probability 1 minus p squared, nothing happens, just the identity. So this is a very, very simple model of noise in quantum error correction. And the idea is that in quantum error correction, we want to use multiple qubits together with some error correcting scheme so that we can reduce the effect of this noise on our system. So the surface code is a very nice topological instruction to do this. The picture, so I want us to focus on the picture on the left here. So in that code, the edges of this graph here, the white edges, are qubits. So there's one qubit per edge. And the stabilizers that you measure are Plaquettes and star operators, z for star and x for Plaquettes. And whenever you measure all of the stabilizers of the code, plus one eigenspace, simultaneous eigenspace, is the code. That's the subset of states which we call the code. And so in this code, when some error happens, let's focus on x errors only. So we're ignoring z errors for now. So when you have an error e, then that is simply a set of edges. So the error e is just some subset of edges on this picture. Maybe I can draw here. So if an error happens, then we can just draw on this picture some set of qubits or edges where that error occurs. And then the idea is you measure the stabilizers and you get a syndrome, which I'll call little s of e. And the syndrome in this code is just the endpoint of these errors. So there's a syndrome here where the stabilizer, this vertex stabilizer, is not satisfied, and here, and here, and here. But not here, because there are two edges going into that vertex. So that stabilizer is satisfied. So the syndrome is what we use to detect the error and correct it. And then, oh, this one doesn't move. And then from that syndrome, we apply some correction. And a correction, again, is a set of edges. So the first set of edges that we applied, the syndrome, we can think of as the boundary of that set of edges. And the correction that we apply, the boundary of it, must also have the same syndrome. So that when we apply the correction, we correct up the syndrome by applying some subset of edges which have the same syndrome as the error itself. So we don't know what these orange lines are, we just know where these circles are. And we apply some Pauli operators, some subset of edges to correct up So one example of a correction which would do that is the picture here. And now, of course, the net effect is that we have applied first an error E, and then we have applied the correction operator C onto that. And of course, the boundary of that, there are no longer any endpoint there. The boundary of that is zero. So the net effect of applying an error and then a correction is that you return to the code space. Cool. Okay. So everybody, most people, I hope, know this, but I know a few of you have not seen this. So one other thing that I think is worth mentioning is you need some classical algorithm. To help you with the decision problem in this quantum error correction setting, which is basically given the syndrome S, what correction should I apply? And that classical algorithm is known as the decoder. And coming up with good, efficient decoders is actually a big problem, a very active area of research for multiple different codes. I'm going to deal with a very simple case here where I'm assuming that, first of all, the correction that we apply is minimum weight. So what I mean by that, I mean that the set of edges that we choose, which correct all of the violated stabilizers, is the smallest set of edges. And the other thing that I will assume is that it is deterministic. So by that, I mean, suppose you have a scenario where there's some syndrome and you need to apply a correction to correct the syndrome, so you return to the code space, then you always apply the same error given the same input syndrome. There may be multiple different subsets of edges which have the same weight for that given syndrome. And I'm assuming that the decoder that we use applies a minimal one, and also that it always applies the same thing. And I said here that I was assuming just X errors, and that allowed me to identify errors with edges. I can do that because the surface code that we're working with here has the property that if you swap every edge, every horizontal edge with every vertical edge, so if you do this swap here in this in the graph above, then what you'll find is that all of the vertices get swapped with plaquettes, and the entire problem is identical for the Z errors as it was for the X errors. Yeah.
Just to clarify, you said that you're thinking of the surface code, but I think you were thinking of the toric code.
I'm thinking, yeah, there's a nomenclature which is used, and I've been convinced of the following by Ben. So what Ben likes to say, and I kind of agree with it after numerous discussions, is the surface code is the actual Hamiltonian that you look at locally, the definition of these stabilizers, and you can apply that to any surface that you want, be it a torus, be it a disk, a plane with a boundary, or whatever. And so the term surface code that I'm using here is kind of just generic. Does that make sense?
Sure. But cool. What manifold are you considering a torus?
I am going to consider a torus here. Yeah, that's right. Good point. Okay, so that was a quick reminder of quantum error correction in the topological setting for the surface code. And I want to also talk about entropy and free energy in this setting. Okay, so in order to do this, I want to first define a set, let's call it curly E, of all failing errors. So let's see, I think I didn't actually mention what it meant to fail yet. So the after the correction was applied to fix up the syndrome, then the net effect was to return us to the code space. But there are two possible cases. Either you return to the same state that you started in the code space, or you return to a different state. And in the case of the service code, we're kind of I want us just to imagine, now that I've drawn in all of the little squares, I'm not going to bother doing that. But in the service code, I'm going to draw two cases. So in the first case, I'm going to draw a simple, relatively low weight error. Maybe I'll make it slightly more interesting. So this error, using a minimum weight decoder, will have violations at all of these endpoints, and will presumably be corrected by something that looks like this. So after the net effect of the error plus correction, these errors cancel because Pauli operators square to the identity, and then down here we just get this small closed loop. But that small closed loop is a stabilizer for the code, and therefore it has no action on the code. So this correction succeeds, even though the error was not actually precisely identified. But there are other scenarios where we have, for example, I'll just make it really clear what's going to happen here. We have other scenarios where there are a few different options of how I could correct this error, but the minimal weight one will actually look like this. And so the minimal weight correction in this case, when combined with the original error, gives you a non-trivial cycle in the course. And this is actually a logical operation which changes you from one code state to another. So this is a failure. So whenever I define this set here, curly E of all failing errors, I mean every original error, so just the set of white edges, every set of original errors, which when you correct will lead to something like this and cause a failure. And then we can split that set of errors up into the disjoint union of subsets of errors of particular weight. So for example, here, this particular error would be in the subset of weight. I have to count the white edges, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this would be in the subset curly E of 6, etc. And one important thing in quantum error correction codes is that actually the lowest weight, if I have a good code like I do here, a code that actually works to correct them errors, the very low weight errors will never cause a failure. So in fact, this disjoint union here only needs to start at half of the distance of the code. What is the distance of the code? The distance of the code is the smallest size of logical operator. So in this particular example, where I have 1, 2, 3, 4 edges across, then the distance is 4. And in this case, n is 32. The number of qubits is 32. OK, cool. So then we can define the failure. So the code will fail with the following probability. Well, I just sum up over this set of errors, which I know fail, I total the number of errors of weight W by the probability of each error of weight W occurring. So hopefully that is fairly clear where that formula comes from. And we can make this a slightly more convenient form by pulling out 1 minus b to the n and taking the exponential of the logarithm of this thing. Seems kind of pointless, but useful. So this is defined to be the entropy for the code, and this is defined to be e to the minus beta for some inverse temperature beta. But really, we should just think of this beta as being a proxy for the error rate p. So
beta is just p over 1 minus b.
Yeah, the internal part inside the parentheses. Yeah. So ignoring the 1 minus b to the n part at the start, we just have the sum over w starting at p over 2. The exponent of beta W minus the entropy. So the square brackets here is known as beta times the free energy. So we define the entropy, and from that we've defined the free energy. And the free energy is really useful for analyzing quantum error correction codes, because it really helps you to pull out what the salient regime of failure is of the quantum error. So typically it will look something like this. On the y-axis here, you'll have theta times f, and the free energy will be infinite below half of the distance, and then the curve will begin. And since we have this exponential here, really the only terms that significantly contribute to the failure are those terms which minimize the free energy. So, for example, if you had two codes, yeah.
So here you're using words entropy, free energy, but a priori they have nothing to do with some, you know, microcanonical ensemble, and you know it's not clear what you're doing here. That you know there is some configuration space. You're counting something. You know. So could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, you can. So you can more formally map to an actual statistical mechanical, classical statistical mechanical model where you make the formal connection. But here it's kind of fairly clear to see roughly what's going on. You have in this picture here, if we imagine this square, you have two different phases that you can imagine thinking about. You have a very low temperature phase, where you have very, very rare errors, and errors are kind of scattered very infrequently among the system. And the question is, how many different configurations of that low density of errors will cause a failure? So the entropy there really is the log of that number. So in a sense, it's the same as the statistical mechanics case, where you the number of micro states. The log of that is the entropy. And here, that's no different. Here, the temperature is fixed by this P. And you can, again, relate that back to, in a more formal way, the why that temperature should map that particular way. But the intuition is the same, I think. But I wouldn't worry too much about the precise mapping to a precise system. So here I drew kind of an imaginary curve of free energy for a particular error correcting code. But I could draw another one too. Like, okay, I drew a bad one because the point I want to make is whenever the minimal point of its free energy is lower. So this code that I've drawn here in pink, which is the same code but kind of translated, or the same curve but translated down and across to the right, it has a lower minima in its free energy. And that code will perform worse than the other code because when it has a lower minima in its free energy, then it has a higher, there's more contribution to the logical error rate. So it fails more often.
So these lines are supposed to be for the same code, but for different decoding algorithms?
They could be, for example. I'm just imagining two different schemes that you could, two different schemes, same number of qubits. You can draw free energy for both. Then you could compare them looking at this. Yeah. And what the, one of the reasons that this is kind of useful to think about free energy is because you then don't need to analyze the entire space. It's really clear that the only real region that you need to understand in detail is the region where the free energy is minimized. And that can save you a lot. Yeah.
But then in the very low rate regime, what your curve indicates that the distance is higher. And you know, then you would sort of think that, you know, the pink code performs better.
Yeah, that's completely correct. So if we draw that regime. So if we draw low P, then, well, let's label a couple of things here. So this point that I labeled here, where the code starts the to have some non-infinite free energy, the actual height of that we can read off from what the definition of free energy is given by this. And for the other code, it's the same formula, but with D replaced by D prime for the other error correct scheme with a different distance. So in the case where you take P really small, beta becomes very large. And this term here is really just contributed to by the beta D over two. You can kind of neglect the entropy part. And then you'll have something which looks like this. And the other code, which has the larger distance, will look like this. And clearly then, the minima of free energy in these cases is just given by details of the distance. So in this case, in the low P regime, clearly the code with the largest distance is better. And that's kind of obvious, I would say.
If P is very big, what happens? There is no minimal?
So if P is really big, it's not super interesting to look for the very large limit. So obviously, P going to 1/2 is kind of the worst case that you can imagine for the error correction setting. And if you look at that, then beta will become very small. And then you will be entropy dominated. So what that means is that all of the different configurations are equally probable. But in reality, for any error correction scheme, that's going to lead to failure. So we're only really interested in P, which is small enough. Yeah.
This free energy can become negative, in fact.
Yes, in principle it can. So I had this proportional sign here. So what will happen is that if this free energy becomes negative, then this blows up. But the reality is that the prefactor, which I left out, 1 minus p to the n, will handle that so that you always get a finite big probability. But yes, this free energy can become negative.
But is it like roughly that scale determines the threshold?
Unfortunately not. It's not, yeah, it's not, you don't, yeah, the p at which threshold happens is, it's related to the phase transition. So definitely whenever this starts to blow up, that will be the threshold for sure. But that's not the very high p regime where p is like 1/2. It will happen well before that.
So your mapping resembles the Denis et al. Mapping.
Yeah.
But they have like e to minus 2 beta.
Yes. So
is there a reason why you have minus beta?
Yeah, I mean, the mapping that I did here is not really a mapping. It just, I mean, I didn't hide anything. I just wrote some things down, but I didn't assume anything or anything like that. They do a mapping to classical statistical mechanics. Slightly different, but it shares a lot of the same features. Okay, I should push on. So in the very low p regime, then the distance is really the most important feature, but we also have a prefactor, which is the number of weight d over 2 errors occur. So this formula here shouldn't be too surprising. The probability of failure for very, very small p is just how many weight d over 2 errors there can be times their probability. So this you can rewrite if you want as e to the s d over 2. Okay. So how this is related to Benny's question. How low does p need to be for us to be able to assume this sort of thing? Well, that's actually generically not an easy question. So if you wanted to answer that question, then in the very general case, you would say, it would occur when the following bound hold. So the worst case scenario for any code is that there's only one, for this, as far as this bound is concerned, is if there's only one error of weight d over 2 that causes a failure, and then every error of higher weight also causes a failure, and then you want to make sure that your p is small enough so that the single weight d over 2 errors still dominate. So you would have to satisfy this inequality. So this is the assumption that I just said. And this would give you a bound which is extremely small. It would be like 1 over n to the d over 2. And of course, d for a code like the service code grows with n. So this is, you would really need to go to very, very small p to be absolutely sure that you're in this low error rate regime. Okay. But of course, for most codes, that's not true. For most codes, you're in this low error rate regime for what are, you have a question there?
Yeah, to what extent is this like a percolation transition?
In the case of the surface code, it really kind of is a percolation transition for you to go from the case where you will correct in the infinite size limit to not correct, which is the threshold of the code, then it really is a percolation transition there. Okay, so the question that I want to address here is the following. So given the two different tilings of the torus, which I'll come back to the second one in a second, we've really been dealing with the first. Given those two tilings, what are the relative error rates? So let's use this notation. What is the what's the probability that the non-rotated code fails given you use a system size n and a small error rate p? And the same for the rotated version. So the rotated version is, it really works in exactly the same way as the other code. But now the logical operators look slightly different because, for example, in the code that I've drawn here, if you had applied x errors all along every edge that I'm drawing here, this would be a logical operator for the code. But this example that I've drawn here has d equals 6 and n equals 36. So not very many more qubits than the first orientation, but a considerably bigger distance, 3/2 bigger distance. So these two orientations of the surface code really have some important differences between them. And the question is, well, first of all, why should we care about this? Why do you care if you use one orientation of the torus or the other? Well, these are really what people are trying to build at the minute in labs. Surface codes are the leading form of error correction at the minute for implementation. And so I think it is a relevant question to think about these kinds of details. Should you use one orientation or the other? So we would like to know, for example, if you have n qubits and you have a probability p of error rate in this noise model, then which code should you use? Pretty straightforward question. But the answer is kind of complicated because even if both of the codes perform the same, it's not to say that you should just use one or the other, because they actually have very considerable differences in other aspects than direct error correction. For example, the non-rotated version appears, at least in known methods, to be much cheaper for certain kinds of fault-tolerant gates. Which is a key part of quantum error correction and computation. And another thing, which is kind of the main thing that we want to look at here, is if you just look at this code, you can quite easily identify what the logical operators are. So what kinds of errors that could occur that would cause the code to fail. You can have a horizontal string like this, or horizontal string like this, or one up here like that, or the vertical ones. There are not very many. But in this case, another weight 6 logical operator is this one, and another one is, you know, this one. There are many. There's a exponential in D number of logical operators in this case, whereas in this case it's just goes like D squared. Sorry, it goes like D. So there might be some significant entropic differences between these two codes, these two orientations. And so the key motivation for this is essentially we know that the distance for the rotated version is much larger than for the non-rotated version. And these are actually the formula for that. Okay. So work here. So what I want to calculate now is the low E limit. for the non-rotated lattice. So this is something that was known before our work, but I want to highlight because some of the ideas there are important. And it's really just calculating the lowest term in the entropy. How many errors are there of minimal weight? So let's call that W. So that we have this equation for the small b limit. Okay. So one strategy that you could use to calculate this is you could say the number of errors of weight d over 2 can be found by splitting my problem up into the following sum. I sum over all logical operators, and then I count for each logical operator the number of errors of weight d over 2, which leads to that logical operator being present post-corrected. So the first thing that we could ask is, well, how many logical operators are there? Well, there's a huge number of logical operators, because if I draw the lattice in my non-rotated lattice, this is a logical operator where I apply x to all edges across this line, but so is this, and so is, you know, if I introduce loops everywhere else, this remains a logical operator. So for me to sum over all logical operators here would be extremely difficult and not really possible. But we are saved because of the following. We the number of weight d over 2 errors which fail to a logical operator must be zero if the weight of the logical operator itself is greater than d. So why is this? Well, the idea here is that if we have suppose we have a weight d over 2 error, which has occurred, which are the only ones that we're counting at the minute, and we conjecture that it fails to give what I just saw here, then maybe it looks like this, something like that. Well, the point is that if the, after filling in everything, if the overall error has weight greater than d, then it must be that either, it must be that the weight of e plus the weight, so the weight of the error plus the weight of the correction is greater than the weight of the final product. And that must be greater than d. So it must be that either, well, yeah, I guess you can just infer that the weight of c then has to be greater than d over 2. Because the weight of e is d over 2. So the weight of the correction plus d over 2 has to be greater than d, so the weight of the correction has to be greater than d over 2. So that tells us that's a contradiction, because we know that there's a correction with lower weight, and we know that we always use minimal weight. So it must be that this conjecture was impossible. So therefore, we know that the number of weight d over 2 errors in this case will be zero. So that's good. That reduces massively the space that we have to point over. Erase forward. Let me do this one. So now, what have we deduced? Well, we know that the number we're looking for, we just have to sum over the weight D logical operators. And we know that for the torus, like the picture I drew over there, that's just all of the horizontal strings and all of the vertical strings. There are D horizontal ones and D vertical ones. So there are a total of two D weight D logical operators. Okay, good. So we know the number of terms in the sum. And now let's think about a particular one. So now the question has reduced to calculating delta, or calculating the number of weight D over two failures for a particular string. So let's draw a particular string which is supposed to appear in our error plus correction. It will be made up of a set of edges. And the question is, and they're going to be D of these, because the weight of this logical operator is D. So the question is, what subset of edges need to have a failure, but need to have an error applied to them in order for us to get this logical operator after correct? So the total number of possibilities is D choose D over T. So does anyone have a guess for this, any chance? If anyone's been paying attention. So almost. The issue here is that because we're working, you know, I have written D over 2, and it, probably the fact is I've been sloppy with this by not specifying. D, I'm assuming, is even here. So since D is even, we have the case where the error and the correction have the same weight, precisely the same weight. So sometimes the decoder will, yeah, one half. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I'm a little confused why you're working in this extremely temperature limit where it's not really too worried about as opposed to some neighborhood.
Excuse me. Sorry, that was probably really bad for me to cough into the mic. it's going to continue. sorry, Dan. Yeah, I agree with you that it's not just me trying to get out of answering your question. the case that we care about is for higher P than this. So it's the case that we would care most about is fix P, make N as big as you want. And that's the case that we head towards. But the case that we can most rigorously understand is this case. And it's and for the rotated lattice, the results are new and they inform the larger case. But we do also study that case as well. I agree. The case we care about most is the bigger case, the fixed key. And also details like this one half are not super relevant. They won't show up very much in the calculation. But the idea is simple, as Alex pointed out. Choose some error, let's choose some error E, which has weight D over 2. Then you can always find, I'll draw below it, you can find the complement of that error along the string. So I should have drawn these two things exactly the same way both times. And these have exactly the same syndrome. So it'll look like that. And the decoder is applies the same correction each time. So it's going to fix one of them and not the other. So it fixes precisely half of the errors. Because you can always pair up the errors. OK. Fine. So we know the answer to this question now, because this is true for all of the errors. So we had two D different logical operators, and for each one, we corrected D choose D over 2, all divided by 2. So that's the case for the non-rotated lattice. Okay, so the rotated lattice is something which wasn't known before, and it's as we'll see in a minute a little bit more complicated. So if we try to use the same strategy as we did before, we could imagine counting all weight D logical operators, and then for each logical operator trying to find the set of errors which, once you correct, lead to that logical operator being there post-correction. So if we want to do that, we can again use the same thing that we used before, that we only need to look at weight D logical operators, not all logical operators. And first we should count how many logical operators there are. So I kind of hinted at this earlier, that there's now going to be an exponential number in D, but they're not too difficult to count them explicitly. So first let's fix along the left-hand side of the torus as I've drawn it, that the logical operator will pass through here. And then it has to reach the same point on the other side of my drawing of the torus. So one example of a weight D logical operator is this one. But I can kind of just, it's easier if I rotate this picture. And you know I've got my lattice that's drawn here like this. It's easier if I rotate the picture so that my lattice is horizontal. And then the picture that I just drew is going from point 0, 0 on the plane to point d over 2 on the plane, and thinking about how many different walks are there to that point. The one that I drew here is, and once I've rotated, is this one. But it's pretty easy to see then that how I got there was I took d over 2 upward steps, in this case 3 as I've drawn it, and then d over 2 rightward steps, but that it doesn't actually matter which way I take those steps. I'll always get to the same point if I take d over 2 right steps and d over 2 up steps. So then it's clear that the number of paths is d choose d over 2. But I fixed that I went through this point here.
There's also one that goes just around.
Yeah, yeah. That's right, yeah. So of this type, I have to count the fact that I could have gone through this point or this point or this point. And if you look at the lattice for a couple of minutes, you'll see that there are d over 2 different points I could go through here. I could have done the same thing. You know, I was looking at going horizontally around the torus. I could have gone vertically around the torus. So there are d over 2 vertical ones. And as Dan just mentioned, there's so many boards. It's really cool. You could also do both horizontal and vertical, like this. And you could go the other way. And there are, again, d over 2 points that you could go through here in order to do that. So you can count all of these up, and you get d times d choose d over 2 plus d, where this d is from the diagonal one. Okay. So So it looks like we're making good progress towards calculating this thing, because we know now how many weight the logical operators there are. But when we come to try and answer the next part, which is, given a logical operator, which subset of errors fail to give that, then we have problems. So let's see that. So suppose this is the logical operator, then, and we ask which subset of errors fail to give this, and I ask, what about this error here? Then, if we try and ask about this particular example, it's possible that the decoder chooses this path to connect these two points, which are going to be the vertices, which are not satisfied. But it could also choose another one. It could go on this way, for example, or, you know, some combination. So, so we can't actually answer this question about how many errors will fail to give this. And that's because I haven't specified enough about our decoder. So the decoder, the minimum weight decoder, is, as stated, is not really well defined.
I mean, what fails that you impose this deterministic correction?
Pardon?
I mean, what's ill-defined?
So the question about what fraction of errors will correct to actually give me precisely this logical operator is not well defined. And this is a problem because of the way I'm trying to count up the error probability, because I'm saying I'm going to separately count all of my different logical operators, and then for each I'm going to collect the errors which cause that failure mode.
Presumably, if you randomize your decoder, wouldn't you arrive at, you know, just this one hub in front of D choose D over 2?
No. In this case, you don't. But it's not,
I mean, it's
super...
You're still overcounting that, right? Because this
error
that you drew is for all of those possible.
Right.
Yeah, so...
You count how many it is, which is different for different errors.
I see. Okay, right.
Yeah, so that's exactly the point. When I come to this path here, and I'm saying how many are here, I'll count this error again, or I could. So the kind of trick that we used to overcome this was we fixed the decoder to make our problem easier. So we say that we have a way of choosing that we correct always as down as possible. So we can, we don't have a name for it, but let's call it the down decoder or something like that. So, and that's now more well defined. And it makes it clear that for the case that I just drew, this correction would be applied rather than the upper. Okay, good. So, so that seems more promising. It distinguishes between these two. What about some other path? For example, this one. So can, well, maybe I should, in fact, go back to this example here. So maybe it's enough, actually, for the first path that I drew, to identify how many errors will correct to give it using the down decoding rule. Anyone guess? So should I wait for a second? Or So it's, if you, the two edges that make up this corner here, this turn, if there's no error in either of those edges, then it will never be selected for sure. So we need an error to be in one of these two, or else it won't count. So that's the first thing. But then you can quickly convince yourself that actually then any placement of errors along the rest of the path will be fine. There's no choice for the decoder. So actually the total number here for this particular case of one, let's call it a right turn in our path as we walk along across the forest like that, the total number is yeah, we can place, so we can place one here, or fill both of them. So if we put it in the left one, then we still have a choice of D minus 2, the non-corner edges, choose D over 2 minus 1. We could do that in left or right, so we get a factor of 2. And if we fill both of them, then we have D minus 2, choose D over 2 minus 2. So that is the total number for that case. I'm out of boards now, at last.
While you're racing, the answer won't actually depend on what decoder you pick, right?
I had hoped not initially, but it does.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one distinction between the Kitaev or the non-rotated version of the lattice and the rotated version is in the non-rotated version, it does not matter. All decoders have the same performance. Which you can view as an advantage or a disadvantage, because if you're willing to hunt for the best decoder, more performance boost. Okay, fine. So I won't go through the details, but if you have R turns rather than just one, as we showed there, then this kind of straightforwardly generalizes. And you just, so S counts, S is the number of singly occupied corners, and you get something which, you know, the exact form is not super important. But I'll write it anyway. So some nice combinatorics. And then something else which is really lucky, in a sense, is that, so before we asked for the total number of weight D logical operators here, but you can calculate exactly, in fact, the total number of weight D logical operators with R, some number of right turns. And it's very simple. We know that you can write down the exact answer. It's slightly different from this, but it's very close. So it's pretty nice, lucky that you can do that. So we can actually just calculate with this decoder then what the total number of lowest weight errors is using this nice combinatorial counting method. Okay, so I would just plug in those things. So that's fine. So you can, for any finite size, you can just calculate that number and plug it in and you know the answer to that. But you can take the limit, you know, you can do the standard technique of taking the sum over stuff to the integral over exponential of log of stuff. And then you can find the minimum of log stuff. And you will have, you know, the maximum, I should say, of log stuff. So you find the maximum of this, and then you have a quadratic, and you just have something which is like this times the Gaussian integral, which is some fixed constant or polynomial. So I won't bother doing this, but you can, and then you can find out what the entropy is. So you can use that to calculate the exact number. And I forgot to write it down, but 1.8. Like that. I can't remember. Anyway, so at this point, I want to see, I'm probably pretty close to time anyway. So I want to pull the thing down. I'm not sure how I.
Just
Okay. So yeah, I want to show some data of this and the larger case. I don't have a lot of time. Looks like my computer has turned off in the meantime. Not a great advertisement for Microsoft. okay. Well, anyway, maybe I'll just describe what I was going to show anyway. So the case that we looked at was the very low P case, where I personally think it's kind of fun that you can calculate these things exactly through some combinatorial methods. And then you can ask, okay, hold on. So you can ask the following question. Well, for the non-rotated lattice, for the small limit, you get some you get this formula for the small e large n error rate, and for the rotated lattice you get another formula and the key difference is that this number is considerably bigger than this number, so you get this entropic effect in the rotated lattice, but this number is smaller than that number, so you get this benefit from the energy term from the load from the larger distance. So, or I should say, this is larger than that. I meant. But these two competing factors are going to turn over at some point. So at very low p, then clearly this one wins. But for some larger p, this is going to start to actually. This formula on the right-hand side is going to start to get better. The question is, are these extrapolations really valid in that regime when they turn over? And we expected that, no, they were not. And you know, I guess you're not going to see the data. But it turns out that actually there is a regime in which the entropy overtakes the energy term, so that the rotated lattice actually does worse than the non-rotated lattice, which was kind of surprising to us. But the reality is the amount better that it is extremely small, and it only exists in a particular regime of N and P. So it's not the case that that everybody should make sure that they're not using rotated surface codes. Most of the time the rotated surface code performs better than the non-rotated one. But not always, and they're very comparable for error rates, which are a sizable fraction of pressure. They really perform very, very similarly. As you might expect, when you get to threshold, their behavior becomes very, very similar. So, okay, yeah, unfortunately, I can't show you the data to prove that. And you can ask the question as to why that is, why this turns over, and it turns out that there's a nice closed mathematical description of the, at least description of the problem that you can check numerically of how many paths there are diagonally between two points a certain distance apart and horizontally on the Manhattan grid. And it seems like really there's a turnover in that, which is causing this behavior to occur where the rotated lattice actually performed worse than the was kind of surprising to us. Okay, that's everything I wanted to say. Modulo some slide data. Thank you. Yeah.
So you have restricted your error model at the beginning of the talk.
Yeah.
How much is the conclusion relying on that specific error model?
It's a good question. I don't know, and I would love to know the answer. I think that numerically we can still probe the more general error models. Analytically, I think we got kind of lucky in a few places that we could come up with analytical solutions to some of the problems in this error model. But making the error model more complicated is, I would doubt that we could do the same analytic.
Just as simple as the equalizing noise.
First of all, you're minimum wage preferred matching before on Northwest. So, you know, your starting point.
Well, I mean, the minimum weight perfect matching decoder could still operate. I mean, you'll still get the.
You mean if you
have noisy syndromes?
Will not match.
Yeah. I guess the question is, if you restrict to the case where you have perfect stabilizer extraction, but you maybe have different ratios of X, Y, and Z errors, then it would be, you would maybe have some hope. But if you went to like a circuit level noise model, then as Alex would say, you'd be in big trouble, or phenomenological.
It's not what I'm saying. I'm saying the polarizing channel. It's not gonna be just pairing points. It's gonna be more complicated. And it will not work.
Wait, I don't understand why. I mean, the depolarizing channel with min weight perfect matching.
The polarizing channel,
yeah,
as the bit flip, they should forget about Y correlations, but by no means this will give you the minimum weight.
Of course, yeah. No, yeah, it's gonna be a not very good decoder for that model.
Yeah.
But it's still okay. I mean, it's not that bad.
Yeah, but then your logic about, you know, like.
Yeah, we can continue after. Sure. Thanks.